Well, good morning. Welcome all to the roundtable for this Friday morning. It's Friday. We made it. We made it to Friday. And that's good. Congratulations to both Sarah and to Ray and to all the WAMC listeners. We're at a great place in the lockbox. We're going to keep going on that. And we'll go back to Lockbox Central in just a little bit. Panel at, WAMC.org to give money to the lockbox. That's how you do that. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. And we need your help. Or you can call us, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. All right. We have a great group today. I'd like to introduce them to you and tell you a little bit about them. And then we'll get started on the news for today. We welcome Teresa Bourgeois to the program, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm so excited to be here. And, you know, I always check my days, and it's National Techie Day. And for to praise the technologist, and we have one of the top ones in the world amongst us, right? So that's and so imagine
someone here I haven't seen.
you're preeminent in your field among techies. Yeah, I know you are humble about it, but nevertheless,
would you self-identify as a techie?
Yeah,
a leader in technology.
The interesting thing about it is, in the old days, techie was a theater term for the guys who were in the back.
Yes, that's true.
Which is actually where I really was a techie back when I was in college. I spent most of my time backstage making things happen. So now, as technologist,
yeah, it's a technologist, right. So it's a national technologist. But cheers to all of our listeners who are, and all who are graced here with people who are, and people running the show are, and
absolutely.
And I have my flip phone, which means I am not.
And I love you for that, by the way.
Anyway, and a quick shout out, thank you to all our listeners who have donated and those who are about to in the next hour or so that we can keep up with the panel going forward. So, when you know, price of a pizza, it could be a personal pan pizza, it could be a medium pizza, it could be a large pizza, it could be a pizza for the whole team.
It could be a pizza party.
A pizza
you
shop.
May have to, you may have to put her on during
Yeah, I know. We're ready.
Anyway, thanks to everybody who's supporting this, because now more than ever, right? And look who we have here with us.
That's right. We have a wonderful group this morning. Jim Handler is the other voice you just heard, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences. I hear he's a techie.
Yes.
Did I insult you inadvertently?
No.
RPI's Jim Handler, good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning. And, you know, like everyone else, the fundraiser's not like my favorite part of everything we do here at WAMC. But I'll tell you, I'm looking forward to Monday morning because I get to man the phones and get to talk to some of the listeners who are out there listening to us today. And it's really nice to hear people say how much this station means to them. So
I
look forward to talking to you.
I don't want to put any pressure on any other panelists, but I will say that the two of you, both Teresa and Jim, spend hours during the fun drive. Not only do they do this for free, but they come in, they take calls, they talk to listeners, and our listeners are the people donating are thrilled to talk to our panelists, and it's just wonderful and really nice to have you in the room while we're doing it.
And so, you guys just can't you couldn't handle my consulting fees. So
well, there you go. That's absolutely true. No, that's why we would need another fund drive, for goodness sakes.
Indeed.
We are thrilled
I'm a techie.
To welcome back for third time.
Yeah,
third time. This is very
this
nice.
Is awesome.
Thank you.
Sophia Acquisto is a RPI graduate student and is joining us. She is a former grade school teacher who has returned to graduate school to get a PhD. And that PhD will be in?
Science and Technology Studies.
Excellent. You too will be a techie.
I will. I am.
I think she is already.
Yeah, already a techie. That's right.
Techies amongst us.
We're thrilled to have you today. We think we want to talk to you about all kinds of things that are within the news, and we're very, very happy to have you with us this morning.
Joe, I wouldn't want to embarrass anybody, but I will point out that.
But Sophia, buckle up.
Sophia has been designing a quantum computing curriculum aimed at middle school girls. So, I mean, when you talk
hear the applause all throughout the WAMC community.
And that will accomplish what? I mean, the end result of that being?
Well, we're trying to get more girls in STEM, and specifically computer science and quantum. And most women lose interest in science by high school, so we're trying to get 7th to 9th grade girls.
Why is that a challenge? What can we do? What do you think we can do to make that an easier sell?
Well, I'm trying to create these interventions at a younger age to get girls excited. So in the point of the program, it's not to turn them into quantum physicists within a few months. It's to get them working together, get excited about quantum computing, see the computer we have on campus, build their confidence and their skills.
Do you remember what got you excited about it?
I think I landed at RPI on accident, honestly.
Yeah.
But I remember I got into this because...
Okay, well, wait a minute.
Well, no.
First of all, you have to get in, which means you have to come visit.
Took a wrong turn outside of Buskirk, and the next thing I knew...
Next thing you know, I was getting a PhD. No, I have the same curiosity everyone else does about the quantum computer. I don't have a background in quantum computing, but when people hear quantum, they just kind of get curious, or robotics. They get excited, and they want to know more.
For those who don't know what quantum is, can you just a little explain?
So the way I put it, and to see Jim closely watching, because I know he's the actual expert on this, the way I explain it to kids is that if a regular computer was binary, so if you flipped a penny and it could land on either heads or tails, a quantum computer is like flipping a penny and it keeps spinning. It could be heads or tails. It could be zero or one at the same time. How does that sound, Jim?
That's not bad. Yeah, the other analogy I like is it's like a light switch versus a dimmer.
Yes.
And sure. Light switch, you're like on or off.
On
and
or
a dimmer,
off.
You can have any value in between on and off.
Mm-hmm. And
it would be a circular.
And the value to that meaning that it's always working, right? It's always going.
Yes.
It can just analyze much, much faster, right? Yes. A broader.
It can be in many states at the same time.
Right.
And now you start getting into the stuff that there's a very famous quote by one of the world's most famous quantum physicists who said, anybody who says they understand quantum physics is wrong.
That's what I'm realizing, too, when I meet more IBM scientists and visit headquarters and things. Like, they all say, well, you know what? We don't know much, but we're here to explore and here to learn more about it. Well,
but it allows you to do much broader analysis, much faster
kinds
pace, right?
Different kinds of analyses at different kind of paces and in different ways. So...
opening up new horizons.
Some of it is to do things faster, but it's certain kinds of computations.
And more simulations running at the same time.
And et cetera, et cetera. But we're not going to spend all day talking about quantum computing.
No, we're not.
Of course, Vox Pop could do a quantum show sometime.
There you go. But I do want to, congratulate
Ray's head explode.
Sophia for the great work you're doing. And thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. It's a delight, as always, to have you,
thank you.
In our studio and joining in on our conversation. All right, let's talk about the shutdown. And this was an exclusive from the Washington Post, which I thought was interesting. I don't think it's especially surprising, but there's actual reporting done here that would indicate of what's going on behind the scenes to back up what I think the hunch was of what was happening behind the scenes. And that is that senior federal officials have quietly counseled several agencies against firing employees while the government is shut down. The president has suggested he will do this, warning that the strategy may, those who are questioning this say that the strategy may violate appropriations law, according to two people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive internal deliberations. The officials caution that firings known as RIFs or
RIFs,
reductions in force. There you go. You're not techies. Could be vulnerable to legal challenges under statutes. Labor union cited this week in a lawsuit seeking to block threatened mass layoffs. For example, the Anti-Deficiency Act prohibits the federal government from obligating or expending any money not appropriated by Congress. It also forbids incurring new expenses during a shutdown when funding has lapsed. Some federal government officials have concluded that the prohibition could extend to the kind of severance payments that a company reductions in force. So just for a little anecdotal background here, the government is shut down. The government's been shut down as of Tuesday. The Republicans and the Democrats cannot agree on a spending plan going forward. They are working on their, well, they are supposed to be working on their differences. A main concern among Republicans is health care. Then
the main concern about Democrats is health care.
Among Democrats is health care. What did I say?
Republicans.
I apologize.
Well, the Republicans concerned because they want to slash it. Democrats
yes.
don't want that.
I apologize. And then you have the president who's saying, okay, well, I'll show you. I'll fire these people. I'll stop these programs. I'll do this, and I'll do it in blue states. So it won't affect my people. It'll affect your people. And there you go. So again, this retribution that is going on. The Trump and Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt, whose office oversees apportionment law, has led the administration's preparation for terminations and have repeatedly said mass dismissals would come during the government shutdown. Plans for such firings have been developed at several agencies, according to two federal officials familiar with the matter, who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity. Those plans would have, which have yet to take effect, outline firings for fewer than 16,000 people, a senior White House official said, a smaller riff than what the White House had previously projected. I'm going to ask a very simple question to start us off, Teresa Bourgeois. Why is this significant?
Why is it significant that the Trump-Vance Vogt administration wants to fire people during a shutdown? Or why is this?
Obviously they want to do this. And obviously there is great concern. And I guess I'm interested of the significance of those who are there in the room saying, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, because it's illegal. That's why it's significant. So this is a continuation of
Which hasn't stopped them.
No. Well, that's, yeah. So this is the only thing different is that they. So, and really, at the heart of the Democrats' refusal to go along with the continuing resolution are two things. One is protecting these really devastating health care cuts that are going to start almost immediately. And people keep saying they're not going to start right away, but they're going to start almost immediately because they will have a tremendous economic impact on the personal lives of the people and on the healthcare business and on the communities in which there is healthcare industry. So, but the second thing is that the Democrats want to say that you, the Trump administration, cannot keep doing what you're doing, which is violating, you know, the First Amendment, which is the administration is ignoring the mandates, the legal mandates of the Congress, and they are withholding or withdrawing or cutting funding, cutting people, and not running the government as the Congress has instructed them to do. So that's really when the Democrats are saying, you know, we're not going to vote for this, what they're not going to vote for is this devastation of the healthcare system and of this illegal activity that's been going on since January that was outlined in Project 2025, which Donald Trump had said he never heard of and didn't know what he was, and they were a bunch of radical people and he didn't agree with it. Of course, yesterday he acknowledged the truth, which is he embraced it, he loves it, he loves his votes. That's why he's put him in charge of it. So what these people in the room are saying is finally, it sounds like there's some people in the room talking to the Trump administration people saying, bridge too far. This is illegal. You cannot do this. You cannot fire all of these people. You shouldn't have been doing it. You can't do it now. But I think, and it's true, it is illegal, but the Republicans are not telling the truth about what the cuts in healthcare mean, right? Yep. They are saying that the Democrats just want to provide health care to illegal immigrants. That is false. They know it's false. They keep repeating it. And everyone says, oh, they have a clear message. They have a message that's clearly a lie. That's the only thing clear about that message. It's clearly a lie. It's not true. And they also say, well, these won't have an impact right away. Vance has said, oh, you know, and right. Johnson, oh, we can do this later. And I know I'm talking a lot, sorry. But just understand, and I'd be interested if any of the listeners have gotten their letters yet, because I know some people who have. These cuts go into effect beginning in January if you are on the exchanges, if you have so-called Obamacare. But you have to sign up or re-sign up in the next, you know, by mid-December. And people are already starting to get their notices saying what their premium increases are going to be. And the premium increases, according to KFF, Kaiser Family Foundation News, the best health news that I can find, you know, straight up, not biased, just factual, is these rate increases are going to be up to 79%. And then some people, like, you know, I got a letter saying that the plan I'm on is no longer going to be offered. So I have to go find a new plan. And if they wait till December, at the end of December, make these changes, then where's the window for people like me who now have to go find a new plan? And rural hospitals
are already
closing. Virginia, yeah. Three key rural hospitals in anticipation of the rising costs that are going to happen because I'm talking too much.
Well, you're not talking too much.
Well, I mean, I want to hear other people.
I do too. But let me just ask you a quick question, and then we'll go to a break, and then we'll come back and we'll listen to everybody else. But this obviously isn't helping the negotiations of trying to end the shutdown.
Was saying that it's illegal?
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, the overall situation.
Let's be clear. The Republicans are not negotiating. And part of the problem here was, so Trump lays out his budget proposals, right? That happened a while ago. And then the appropriators, House, Senate, come together, try to resolve their differences. Well, part of the stage we're at is the Republicans haven't resolved their own internal differences about these bills, right? And so you have appropriations bills that have come out of the House and out of the Senate, and the Republicans can't even get agreement with among the Republicans. And they're not sitting down. The appropriators have been sitting down with each other. They were working through a plan. Trump's administration told the Republicans to stop. And Trump, his first meeting on the budget was the day before the shutdown, where he seemed to not realize who Jeffries was, the House lead, Democratic leader.
Oh, he knew. He released an AI fake right before the meeting.
And he seemed confused about him. He seemed confused about a lot of things. You know, I mean, it was shocking. He golfed the entire weekend. Any other president would have spent the weekend trying to work out something. He spent it golfing. And maybe what else? He went to the, what was that, Ryder Cup?
Oh, the Ryder thing? Cup. Yeah, the golf.
Where they were all being rude to the Irish folks.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that.
Well, that's one thing I will not stand for.
I knew, yeah. I knew that would get up your dander.
We'll get my Irish up
get
as well. Well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to Jim and Sophia.
The aficionados of golf are just guffawing at me.
We'll check in right after this short break. In the cracks in the sidewalks, where the shops shut down. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Listening to Jeff Tweedy's new triple album, Twilight Override, and that'll be our bumper music for the remainder of the panel segment this morning. You can see the playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. And if you just go to wamc.org, you can help out and help the lockbox, wamc.org, wamc.org. All right. We are talking about shutdown. We're talking about concerns over the firing of individuals during that shutdown. Jim Handler.
So I just wanted two quickies. One is Teresa said First Amendment, and that is actually, I want to say it's even more strong than that. It's the first article of the Constitution.
Yeah, so Article 1, totally base. My mistake. Sorry, Caesar.
Yeah, not a big deal.
But well, fired the other up thing and misfired. Is,
the other thing that has come up during this, and it was actually hidden deep within this article, but I think it's a really interesting one. When you lay someone off, you have to give them severance pay. That severance pay comes out of government money that is frozen during the shutdown.
So you can't do that.
So, well, there's this question of how the government could do a costly action without any congressional approval during the shutdown. So they keep saying, you know, we'll do this. It'll, you know, Democrats have given us an excuse to fire all these people we wanted to fire anyway, except that they can't do it. So it's yet another misstatement from the Trump administration. But.
Sophia.
I think right now when it comes to the shutdown, I hate to say it, less concerned about what's happening in government and just more concerned about us. Like, I'm worried about the people that are getting laid off. I'm worried about, really as an educator, about Head Start programs. Yeah. Head Start is a federal program across the U.S. that really helps children and low-income families. It offers educational services, health services, nutrition services, resources for parents. And there's a few programs that have grant cycles beginning in October 1st that were disrupted in their funding. And if the shutdown continues into November or December, more programs could be disrupted. So I'm always more concerned personally about what's happening to young people and what's happening to families.
And especially the long-range effects of if this grinds on for
absolutely
a month or longer.
And these are all children. Sorry. These are all children who are younger than five. And, of course, I don't think the shutdown will be as extensive in affecting education as the pandemic was. But just to say that we are still seeing effects of what happened from elementary students who were in school during the pandemic and when they
absolutely
had learning loss. And now these are children who are missing out opportunities possibly in early childhood development and resources at a young age. So, you know, depending on how long this lasts, there could be lasting impacts.
And if America wants a future, those are our future.
That's right.
I'd like to add to that because there are a couple of other areas. There are many areas that are going to be important. What happens to TSA, you know, airport folks who mm-hmm. are working hard and not getting paid, or air traffic controllers. You know, the last time after a while, they just started calling in sick because, you know, remember this time it's much more serious because the Trump administration has laid off enormous numbers of air traffic controllers, driven them out. So there aren't enough already. Mm-hmm. They're under tremendous stress. And now you add on top of that, they're not getting paid. And so if they start calling out, that's going to be a problem. A friend of mine alerted me to a Military Times story that talked about how yesterday in Texas there were long, long lines at the local food bank that's at the Y that serves this military base, and they showed pictures of nearly bare shelves, and they said just there's tremendous anxiety, and so they get paid, as I was talking to somebody yesterday, up till October 15th, but after mm-hmm. October 15th, these military folks don't have a paycheck. The WIC program, the number of states can carry the WIC program. I was listening to one state official on a newscast yesterday saying that they can cover it for up to 48 days because they did some pre-planning and in anticipation. But beyond that, and for others, you know, it's a much shorter time horizon than that. So already there are people who want to buy homes, but you need federal, it requires federal flood insurance. You can always only get it through the federal government. They can't do that right now. And then there's another thing that might, when you're talking about, you know, women, infant children, pregnant women not getting the food and nutrition, SNAP mm-hmm. all of those things. There's actually a whole other issue about the number of military who are depending on SNAP benefits, who if these Republican cuts get implemented as they're scheduled to and don't get changed, a number of military folks are going to be hurt by those SNAP benefits. But today, channeling Aaron Pacetti, the jobs report should have come out. And it's not coming out because
right.
those folks aren't working. But I will also add that the Trump administration says that there's no longer collecting some of the data that's supposed to be in the jobs report. So that's a whole other kettle of fish. And in any case, and one of the other things that they're doing that I think is potentially illegal, I've read different views on this, but maybe a violation of the Hatch Act, is what they're doing on the government websites. And so if
yes.
you go to the HUD website, They have a big red banner that says, and I'm quoting, "The radical left in Congress shut down the government. HUD will use available resources to help Americans in need." Now, I thought that, and so that's unprecedented and may be a violation of the Hatch Act. But let's go back. How much do they really want to help people in need? I went back and looked at what the Trump vote Vance budget proposal was for HUD, Congressional Research Service. They requested $33.2 billion. That's a 59% cut in HUD's overall budget. That's what the Trump administration asked for HUD. And that means that they're eliminating Section 8 housing. They're eliminating community development block grant funds, housing for the elderly funding, housing for persons with disabilities, these self-sufficiency programs to assist people in housing stability, neighborhood housing grants. They are cutting funding, zero funding, the Office of Lead Hazard Control. It goes on and on and on. They want to defund the Section 8 program. So these folks put a banner that's probably illegal on the HUD website, that's Housing and Urban Development. Yet, you know, don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget, and I'll tell you what you value. And they want to create a housing crisis, and it will create more homeless, yet they want to eliminate much of the funding for homeless programs.
Jim, just have about a minute before.
No, I was just nodding.
Oh, okay.
But what other programming? What about the university-based cuts?
On and on and on. The university challenges were otherwise. Many of the funding agencies already got their appropriation, but now they don't have the people necessarily to run the reviews, to do the things. So it'll put another pause in an already broken system. But we're already fighting, I think. Somebody quoted me the number of lawsuits that concern the various kinds of cuts to educational support, not even including the H-1B visas, which is probably the most devastating for universities because a lot of our assistant professors are here on H-1Bs before they can get the kind of permanent visas that let them stay. And many of these are the top students from around the world who now we're saying, go away, we'll replace you with Americans, except we don't have the Americans in grad school, and they can't afford to go to grad school because the government is cutting all the grants that paid for them to go to grad school.
Cancer research for kids.
So many impacts and dominoes that fall as a result of these decisions. We're going to come back. We'll have a couple of letters. We'll move on to other subjects. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a few messages, and then we'll go back to Lockbox Central with Sarah LeDuc and David Gustina.
How did it go?
Welcome back to the roundtable. I'm sorry, I was getting into an argument with Teresa.
It wasn't an argument. Well, kind of it was.
A heated discussion. It wasn't even heated. It was
a heated agreement.
Heated. We were
agreeing loudly.
Actually, it was not. We were just. I think we both had
different
perspectives on something and fundamentally agree, but. Yeah, but we've talked about it on the panel over the last couple of days, so we won't bore you with that. let me get to some letters that we have regarding the shutdown, and we'll talk about some other stuff here as well. David said whether or not they had the shutdown, cutting more federal employees is what Trump was going to attempt to do anyway. Any fantasies on the part of the Republicans that the Democrats will get blamed for the shutdown is in denial of the fact that they have been the moving party all year long and all the government destruction and downsizing and wrecking of the economy and all that. The vast majority of Americans, especially independents, not necessarily the people who've been drinking the toxic Kool-Aid all these years on the right, will clearly see that the destruction what the destruction is, who's been doing it, and the Republicans will correctly get all the blame. That actually was exactly what we were talking about.
Yeah. So,
exactly.
You know, the interesting thing, Joe, is I was listening to someone who I'm not always in complete agreement with, Newt Gingrich. In fact, I don't think, never mind. I was going to say, I'm not sure I've ever been in agreement, but.
I lived through this.
But
I
this is one thing, but this is one thing I actually agree with him on. He yes. said, whichever side has gotten the blame for the shutdown has always had to cave. But he was saying, and of course he was blaming the Democrats for this one because he's Newt Gingrich. But interestingly, it's very unclear what happens when you have a split public that's sort of half the people are blaming one side and half for the other without knowing anything about it. And I think that's going to be really a determiner of how long this shutdown lasts.
Well, I think it's public opinion is going to help drive this. I agree with that. And the question is, will people, you know, particularly as people, I think as people, more people get their notices about their increase in their health premiums, that there's more discussion about the increase in health premiums. And I wish the conversation could shift, I mean, in this room, I mean, nationally, from who, you know, what's the politics of this to, as you were saying to me, what's the impact of this? Mm-hmm. What's the impact of the shutdown versus, and what's the impact of what they're fighting over? What's the impact of these cuts, when I would call them illegal cuts? Because that's really where the discussion needs to be. Who's on the right side of the substance of this? What's the impact on people's lives, on the price of goods?
We have this letter from listener Liz, who says, we're Dems and Republicans in Congress discussing trying to negotiate about health issues before the shutdown? If so, how can Republicans demand now that negotiation can only begin if the Democrats agree to the continuing resolution?
The Democrats were trying to negotiate. The appropriators were negotiating. The Trump team told the Republicans to stop. And they, the administration, was not negotiating. I think that they want to be able to make these additional cuts.
And in fact, the previous time where people said, you know, Schumer, quote, caved, unquote, really what happened was towards the end, you had a week where they got bipartisan participation. Democrats didn't get much out of it. But they got that they would be included in the discussion. This time, the Republicans refused to negotiate. They left town a day early. I mean, it was like they still had hours left where they, right. You know, the last minute fix that's happened in the past wasn't even possible.
And let's remember.
And I do want to say that Joe took a poll of the panelists on Monday as to which of us believed there would be a shutdown, and we were 100% correct.
Everybody was right, yes.
And I think it's important to remember why the House left is because it was a special election, and a congresswoman,
yes.
A Democrat, was elected, and they wanted to swear her in, as is tradition. But if the House wasn't in session, they weren't going to swear her in. And the Republicans didn't want her to swear in because
she would have been the vote on Epstein
to allow the Epstein documents mm-hmm. to become public.
So you have a bull, and the bull is there and is just rampaging the streets. And then somebody walks out and takes out a bright red cloth. And the bull loses its stuff. Let me read the letter from Lillian, and let's watch Teresa. I just looked up the Hatch Act, and everybody in the government has violated the Hatch Act, Democrats included. Please don't do what the fringes of the parties do. Be fair. The Democrats are just as much a problem as the Republicans, or they could have stopped all this madness in the first term. The Democrats hid Biden's health problems. They own this second term.
Well, there's a lot there. So I don't even know where to go. But thank you for writing. Seriously, thank you for writing. I think the Hatch Act is a question. The Democrats have, in fact, on occasion, violated the Hatch Act. The blatant violation of the Hatch Act is oftentimes the current press secretary. It's astounding to me how often. And I remember a couple of times when Biden's various press secretaries would say something that would violate the Hatch Act, the Republicans would go crazy. And repeatedly, conservative Fox News and other reporters would ask questions, and the press secretary would say, I can't answer that. That would be a violation of the Hatch Act. So they were baited by doing that. But this, what they're doing to the government websites, no one's ever done before.
Right. And the, you know, so the listeners, you know, there may be some who don't understand what the Hatch Act is, and to go into all of its details would obviously be very, very hard. But essentially, if you're employed by the government, on your personal time, you can do and say whatever you want politically. Now, that gets into some issues, particularly with this administration, but in theory. Okay. But when you are in your official capacity, you are not allowed to do anything that can be seen as political advocacy for one side or the other. So essentially what Teresa's saying is by putting this thing on the web page, you know, that has to have been done by someone in their official capacity because you can't unofficially change a government web page. And it is clearly partisan and blaming a group, you know, emphasizing an electoral issue. So this is why it would be obviously a blatant Hatch Act violation. Now, there are many very subtle Hatch Act violations. So when I was on a government advisory board and I came onto this show, I would have to make it clear for certain of my comments that I was talking in my personal role. Right. So I was allowed to say these things. I just had to make it very clear that I wasn't representing DHS or DOE or DOD, all the groups I've worked with over the years.
And you can't use government resources. So you can't use your own time or government resources. But go ahead.
Yeah, basically. And so essentially, I mean, there's a lot of details and a lot of things. During the first Trump administration, several of his people were accused of Hatch Act violations that were very, very egregious, but there's not really an enforcement provision in the Hatch Act. Theoretically, violating the Hatch Act means you can lose your job. In practice, there's very little to do. And as politics has become more and more caustic, oh, and by the way, the Congress is immune to the Hatch Act for obvious reasons, right? You, when you're in your role as a congressman, you're expected to be talking with respect to the issues that, but congressional staffers, others, they're not allowed to do it. You can't raise funding on government time, et cetera, et cetera. So the Hatch Act is put in to try to make it so that the government employees during their government employment must stay neutral with respect to, quote, political issues.
But I would like to also, though, add to the writer again, thank you, but the point I was making, whether or not the changing of the website and the language on the website violates the Hatch Act, it certainly is
unprecedented
and flat out wrong when they say HUD will use available resources to help Americans in need. That's a disinformation campaign. And just look at the Congressional Research Service report on the Republican Trump administration's proposals for HUD in terms of helping people in need. 59% cut in the budget. That's the point I was trying to make. You know, don't tell me what your values are. Show me your budget, and I will tell you what your values are. And they want to totally, and that's just for one agency. Go across agencies, look at the education department, so on and so forth. And as to competency of our president, I think some serious, well, we need to, let's go on to the next slide.
All right. let's go to other topics here. We will talk about, this is a question about the shutdown, and so we're not going to go too far away from the topic. But the shutdown is gutting U.S. cybersecurity and an agency at a perilous time. This from the Washington Post. So the lead U.S. agency for protecting the electric grid, the water supply, and other critical services from hacking has furloughed most of its already trimmed down staff in the government shutdown, just as a decade-old law giving companies leeway to collaborate on cyber defense expired. The twin impacts leave employees at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency and outside professionals unsettled as they try to fend off a surge in sophisticated hacks from China, as well as continued ransomware threats. CISA, is that CISA?
CISA.
CISA is set to keep 889 employees, 35% of the workforce it had in May, according to a planning document released by its parent department, the Department of Homeland Security. More will be available for emergencies, according to DHS. CISA remains fully committed to safeguarding the nation's critical infrastructure, said the agency spokeswoman Marcy McCarthy. While a government shutdown can disrupt federal operations, CISA will sustain essential functions. What does that mean, Jim Henler?
You know, so first of all, this administration came in with CISA on its hit list because CISA has the responsibility to make sure, among other things, to protect election security from foreign influence, things like that, through hacking. So one of the problems is this is already was a political issue around this government. The CISA was set up so there would be essentially a central entity handling cybersecurity, which had been distributed across the government. And it gets complicated because there are really two or three different laws that dominate cybersecurity. But roughly speaking, one is protection of domestic cyber, and the other one is use of cybersecurity during warfare. And that one belongs more to the DOD and can be talked about. These two agencies cooperate quite closely because obviously if someone in China is attacking something in the U.S. infrastructure, that has both an international and a national component. But the but one of the critical things that came out absolutely bipartisan and still has bipartisan support is that here's a problem. Every now and then you get a letter that says, hey, you know, we are now informing you that your, you know, there was a hack on our records and some of your information is out there. You might want to change every password you have to everything and stop everything and da-da-da. And in some cases, they say we've enrolled you for free for a month or a year in some protection thing. But one of the things that was going on was if a company voluntarily said, hey, we've been hacked, then their users, their stockholders, other people can theoretically sue them for negligence if quote, they weren't up to standards. What this law that's being discussed is allowed these companies to have protection against that. It required them to inform people whose information might have been compromised, but it also allowed them to publicly say to each other, to share something that says, hey, this is how these guys broke into my systems. You might want to protect your systems against that same kind of attack. It was voluntary. Companies were not forced to do it. But over time, more and more companies enrolled in it because they realized that by sharing the information, everybody, the rising tide was raising right. all boats.
Right.
And the problem is
got about 30
not
seconds,
that they don't want to keep doing this. But that when that law expires, now suddenly they can go back to being sued for all these things. So until the shutdown's over, companies are highly incentivized not to share information, which has been one of the crucial things that has happened in the past years to make our cybersecurity systems more secure.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation on this subject, move on to others as well. We welcome you to stay tuned and to listen in as David Gustina and Sarah LeDuc remind you of the importance of our lockbox. We'll continue right after this short break.
The Stray Cats are playing in Spain.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 3rd of October, the Friday before the fun drive begins in earnest, 6 a.m. on Monday morning. You just heard the incredible news about a challenge that is underway that we need to make by noon today. So please do whatever you can, WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and we'll have more reminders throughout the morning as we get ready. And Sarah and I will be back in Lockbox Central as of 11:30 this morning. So we had a screw up. Originally, we were going to introduce you to a brand new panelist at 9:30 this morning, but we got the time wrong, and so he is here at 10:30 instead of 9:30, which is completely our fault. But we are very thrilled to have. So two things. First of all, you have to come back because we have to make it up to you. But second of all, because you've come in, you've walked in at a full, and I mean this lovingly, you've come in this at a full Teresa rant. It usually takes some time for her to work up to that, and if you're there for the ramp up, it isn't as alarming as when you just walk in.
Coming in mid-stream.
Because poor Justin just walked into just like a brick wall.
And today the ramp up was what, 4 seconds before we had full Teresa.
So,
the country's in trouble and I care about the people. I care about how this is impacting the peace.
Yes, yeah, so I understand that.
So let me introduce Justin. This guy is fascinating to me and I'm thrilled he's joining us as a panelist. Justin Patch studies music in American politics, sound studies, East Asian art, music and music in the African diaspora. He is currently engaged in two projects, a monograph on the artistic practices of contemporary American populism and an ethnographic study of sound and religion in the post-industrial areas of the Hudson Valley. You say, what is a nice chair, professor and chair of music doing on a somewhat political talk show? And the answer is, well, you're not really going all that far away from your bailiwick, are you?
No, I love political culture. And I think what brings me to this panel is that politics is so much about culture more than it is about policy. Like when you listen to political debates, people are talking about the cultural aspect of it. And, you know, I was talking to my brother on the phone last night and he said, you know, if somebody likes you, they automatically think that you do what they do. And one of the things I found out when looking at Trump art and reading what people who supported Trump thought about him is you could ask four Trumpers, what does Trump stand for, and get four totally contradictory answers. Because as long as you like that person, you assume that even if they say nothing about policy, that they are going to do policies that benefit you. And I think some people are finding out that that's incorrect the hard way. But nonetheless, culture is the sell. And so I come to politics, the study of politics through studying culture. And at this moment, that is so important.
You also look at music and politics and give us a sense of how those two come together.
So what I looked at is how political entities, political campaigns and political parties make use of music and what they think they're doing as they do it, how it affects the aesthetics that they put out, what they use in their advertising campaigns, what they do with their live appearances and stuff like that, and trying to understand how politicians understand music and how they understand their public through music.
Okay. We're going to get back to a conversation on cybersecurity, but four letters that I just have to ask Justin about. YMCA.
That, okay. I think there was a commentary I read online with a guy who said, how is the most homophobic Republican Party that we've seen probably for two decades getting down to the gayest song that any of us have ever heard in our lives?
Right.
Right. And it's, and it is that contradiction. If you believe in Donald Trump, you can erase the practical history of that song and what that song meant and believe that it means something completely different. And I think part of cultural power is the ability to re-signify culture to make people think it means what you tell them it means, rather than what its history and its makers said that it meant.
Justin Patch is associate professor and chair of music at Vassar and is going to be joining us on the panel today and in the future, and we're thrilled to have him. So welcome aboard.
Thank you
very
so much.
Really nice to have you. So we were, well, you probably heard this while you were driving in, but we were talking about cybersecurity. Ed, did you want to make one more point before we?
Yes, I just, before we go off the story or go on to any rants about it, I think it's really crucial to understand something. The community that studies cybersecurity saw a significant influence in favor of Trump in 2016. Now, there's a lot of issues as to whether that had impact or how much impact, et cetera, but no one who has studied it in any scientific way has denied that it occurred. There is some controversy over exactly where it came from and how much. That is why the Trump administration is trying to gut cybersecurity. Now, you then switch to CISA, the agency we've been talking about. They're the ones who are protecting our power grid. That is, making sure that there's no attack via cyber attack that will shut down your lights, right? You may remember the Colonial Pipeline that for a week gas was almost, the gas prices were shooting up on the East Coast. The attack was not on the gas pipelines. The attack was on the central management of those gas pipelines. Again, something which CISA controls or was put in place to help deal with. So attacks on these companies, hospitals, banks, governments, right? All of these things are what this agency that was cut down to 39% before the shutdown was doing. And I mean, I subscribe to the CISA newsletter and it would come out. I mean, I couldn't understand two-thirds of this stuff. It was very deep. It's like if you're using this operating system with this control thing in it and this, you got to be really careful about such and such. You may remember that there was a a flaw in a piece of software that caused our entire air control systems to get screwed up, and you had days delay, particularly by one or two airlines. All of that, again, was things that get introduced sometimes on purpose, sometimes by accident. This is the agency whose job it is to fix that stuff, to help. And that's one where they did step in and they helped minimize the damage very quickly by getting the companies to share the information about how they'd been impacted under this protection law that just expired and cannot be renewed until the shutdown is over. So this, you know, if I was a foreign agent trying to do some hacking against the U.S., I would be really excited to try to get something going in the next two or three weeks. And my few friends who work at CISA still are desperate. You know, they're considered necessary employees, which means they don't get paid until after. You know, they're guaranteed that they'll get their money back. Some of them do maintain paychecks. It's a complicated system.
So, I mean, my question about this is, what is the end game? Is the end game of dismantling CISA to essentially privatize it, the way we saw a lot of agencies get privatized in the 80s, and particularly after the 2000s, or just to do without cybersecurity and just outsource it to companies and municipalities and basically pass the burden off onto local taxes to pay for, you know, securing your grid, securing your city, all of the city offices, all the municipal offices.
So let me answer that two ways. One is the primary attack on CISA and cyber has been political retribution and had nothing to do with the question you just asked.
Nothing to do with money.
Now, that said, actually a lot of the big tech companies are pushing hard to get this law back in place because you're Microsoft, right? Some company has discovered a flaw that let information out or that shut down their machine or something. And this law made it so they could share that information not only with Microsoft, but with lots of other Microsoft users, right? Microsoft likes that, right? Now you have it that company, they still can inform Microsoft back, but they're taking a legal risk. So yes, there will be outsourcing, there will be other things, but basically it's saying something that we, the tech community, fought for years and years to centralize because you must have centralized information to do this right, is now being decentralized again, largely because of political retribution to start and now because of all these other factors, many of which are the ones you named.
Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show. We have about 15 minutes left. We will do that in just a moment after this.
Support comes from handcrafted Oktoberfest Rhinebeck, juried art and crafts, live music, harvest activities, a petting zoo, and carriage rides, October 4th and 5th, Dutchess County Fairgrounds, quailhollow.com, and Poughkeepsie Public Library, hosting their big read event, Eve of the Revolution, featuring Rise to Rebellion by Jeff Shara, author talk on October 18th. POKLIB.org for reservations and more info.
Feel free, get on the floor and dream. Cutting pictures out of a magazine. Feel free. Feel free, plant yourself like a seed.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, Sophia Acquisto, and Justin Patch from Vassar College joining us. And we are thrilled to have you all here. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Last topic before we end the panel this morning, and we put the panel and the show on hiatus while we raise money and we have a big fund drive. And if you're saying to yourself, well, how long is that going to last? Well, it's up to you. You tell us. And if you're ready to end it, you're ready to end it, and we're ready to come back and just tap us on the shoulder, and we'll be here when you're all done and we make the money that we have to make. So far, it's been going wonderful. We have a challenge underway. Whatever you can do to help in the challenge, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Okay, let's go to final story for this morning. The best-selling horror writer Stephen King was the most banned author over the past school year, according to a report by Free Expression organization PEN America, which found that his works had been restricted in 206 instances. Now, this came out of a report that PEN America does every year. We are getting into Banned Book Week, which begins next week. And it is a really big deal in the book community because it gives you an idea of just how many books are being banned, why they're being banned, and where they're being banned, and ultimately allowing people to figure out if they want to, how they can stop that and make sure that it doesn't keep happening in our schools and in our libraries across the United States of America. The report calls this a disturbing normalization of book bans in U.S. schools. They are the new normal, according to PEN America. I should note that we had the folks from PEN America and on earlier this week, and an author who has had their book banned, and a librarian who is working very hard on these issues. And if you want to listen to that, it is available online. But in the report, PEN America said the federal government has emerged in 2025 as the newest force fueling campaigns to restrict materials related to race, racism, and LGBTQ plus issues. There were 6,870 instances of book bans across 23 states and 87 public school districts in the 24-25 school year, the report said. PEN America works to promote freedom of expression in the literary space. According to the report, which was released on Wednesday ahead of Banned Book Week, which is October 5th through the 11th, Florida... Anyone going to act surprised? No? Okay. Florida had the highest number of book bans with 2,304, followed by Texas and Tennessee. Sophia.
Well, I'd certainly agree it's a disturbing normalization. I did some research on this when I was pursuing my master's, and book bans tend to be pushed by ultra-conservative groups and parent groups like Moms for Liberty, and it's true that a disproportionate number of books banned are children's books, picture books, and ones related to LGBTQ topics or subjects related to race. And according to the American Library Association, in 2022, 8 out of the 10 most challenged books in the U.S. had LGBTQ themes. There's a very famous book in elementary schools that's banned. It's called And Tango Makes Three. I don't know if you're familiar with it. So it's a true story. Two male emperor penguins in 1999 raised a chick together in New York's Central Park Zoo. And Justin Richardson and Peter Parnell, a married gay couple in New York City, co-wrote a children's book about it, and it's banned on pretty much every book list every year since it was published. So I want to talk about how LGBTQ media representation is just so, so unbelievably important, especially for elementary schools. There are 1.8 million LGBTQ youth that are seriously considering suicide each year in the U.S., and one attempts about every 45 seconds. So when you have negative anti-gay messages, they compound on kids' mental health. And representation matters because the safe spaces that create in schools can literally save children's lives. So libraries should be these safe and supportive spaces, and LGBTQ story times prevent bullying, but also for teachers or librarians out there who are in learning environments and don't feel safe sharing pro-LGBTQ messages but still want their students to feel safe. UNESCO actually advocates for what they call the Human Rights Framework for Education, which pretty much says that you can discuss the importance of respecting people no matter who they are, and you can incorporate that into your bookshelves and libraries without directly addressing LGBTQ themes. So children's books like Wonder, Chrysanthemum, Bad Case of the Stripes, Hair Love, Those Shoes, these are all books that have themes of promoting respect. And also libraries are resources. Like, I don't just mean for checking out books. They have computers, and students can use them to freely access LGBTQ information like the Trevor Project or GLAAD, G-L-A-A-D. Every student deserves to feel respected and safe and celebrated. And I also want to note that public libraries are run by their school. Public libraries are run by their board, which a local elections control. And we actually just had a local library board election at Detroit Public Library a couple weeks ago that I voted at. So people may think that local elections don't matter, but the process of book banning is actually really determined by your local elections. So that's just one more reason that you should get out there to vote locally, because that can have an impact for book bans.
So I just want to share just one brief story. A former student of mine, maybe about 10 years ago when he was working on his or thinking about his senior thesis. This is late in his junior year. And he said, you know, I grew up in small town Wisconsin. I knew I was gay. Mm-hmm. There were no resources for me, so I found out about homosexuality via porn. And he was like, that is the worst place to explore your sexuality. Right. And so that he was a big advocate for, you know, sexuality inclusive sex ed, because he was like, I had a really unhealthy sense of sexuality because the one resource that was available to me is the worst resources to go to, mm-hmm. to explore that kind of thing.
I don't know why people think that if you take something away from a library, that the situation is then going to go away. Like, you're going to stop kids from being gay. You're going to stop trans kids from doing what they want to do because you take a book away. I just want to get this in. We have a few minutes to talk about this, but you mentioned the book "And Tango Makes Three," mm-hmm. Justin Richardson and Peter Parnell. They're going to be receiving a Bravery in Literature Award, the Eleanor Roosevelt Award for Bravery in Literature, on October 11th at the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie. And it's a very big deal. They'll be going to be doing that along with many other authors, including John Green and Melinda Lowe, who was an author who was on our show earlier this week for Last Night at the Telegraph Club. And because the Eleanor Roosevelt Center is doing this and putting this on with PEN America, they are honoring with a Lifetime Achievement Award Margaret Atwood, who is the author of another mm-hmm. book that has been banned left and right, and that is Handmaid's Tale. And I will be doing the keynote, the fireside chat. How cool! How cute is that, right?
So cute.
The fireside chat with Margaret Atwood on Saturday the 11th. So you can find out more information about that by going to bardavon.org and check them out and see. But it's going to be quite an evening that PEN America and the Eleanor Roosevelt Center will put together to celebrate authors and activists who are fighting, and not only authors but also librarians and other people who are in this and need to be celebrated for the work they
do. So, Joe, I was just going to add one more list of people to that. So, you know, so we have race, we have LGBT, but this administration, which is trying to argue for its strong opposition to anti-Semitic whatever, one of the first books banned, and one that was banned very widely, is a book called Mouse, M-A-U-S,
yeah.
which is
Art's
primarily,
Art Spiegelman, yeah.
Yeah, it is primarily a book. It's not primarily about the Holocaust, but it uses the Holocaust as the running theme. And it's a book which, when you finish it and someone tells you the Holocaust didn't exist, you have trouble believing them. Yeah. So that was one of the first books they wanted to get rid of.
Yeah.
This is this administration that is... arguing that, quote, anti-Semitism is bad, unquote.
I mean, this is the ostrich approach, right? If you don't see it, it means it doesn't exist. And a lot of it looks like at face value, it's about what does society look like on the surface. And there's very little depth. Oh, if we don't see homosexuality, if we don't see trans folks, if we don't see same-sex couples, if we don't see interracial marriages, like, then everything is fine. And that's not how society works, right? What you're looking for is a kind of depth that is, you know, that allows for a party that talks about freedom, that allows people to be free who they are no matter what. And the surface, very like television presentational approach to governance seems really problematic for actual life.
Two things that came out of this PEN America report, which you can look at if you go to the PEN America website, which is really worth reading, because it also includes the list of the most banned books in the past year. But one of the things that we should, I think, take as a positive, which is that there are relatively few groups doing this, but man, they have a lot of impact.
Yeah.
They have a lot of impact, but there are relatively few groups that are doing it. But it's getting to them. The other thing. Librarians are so badass.
Oh my God.
So what they're doing now is going into libraries and offering kids apps that they can put on their phones, and they have access to those books through the library, so they don't have to have them, but they will still have access to them.
Yeah.
Also,
and that is really incredible.
Also, I just appreciate the fact that we have banned book lists. Like, you go to bookstores and they have banned book shelves, or you go to a classroom or a library and they have, these are our banned books. Like, there's power in that.
Yeah, except you don't see it so much if you live in Florida or, or Tennessee. And that's really part of what's causing the culture wars.
Yeah, I mean, but again, the internet, right? Not you want to find some Stephen King, you want to find some... Just go online, you can find a PDF. So this idea of banning it, making it go away, but you're driving people into a place that becomes even more predictable and unsafe than a library.
I was at Midas the other day, and there was a Stephen King book on the counter. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, last word,
I just want to say,
30 seconds.
This is part of a larger Trump effort. In his first term, he tried to defund the Institute of Museum and Library Services. He failed. So this time, March 14th, executive order, which essentially cuts, you know, it doesn't completely defund them, but it certainly guts them. And, you know, libraries are sacred. You know, I've been really sad about our own city that we had a beautiful library. It's closed. It's sort of one room thing now. But it's same thing with the cybersecurity. You know, that's part of a larger thing, a larger cut in these kinds of funding across the board. That's why the Democrats are trying to fight on behalf of these issues.
Teresa, thank you very much for being here as always. We love having you here.
Fired up, ready to go.
Sophia Acquisto, we hadn't noticed. Sophia Acquisto, thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Jim Hendler. Justin Patch, as I said, we'll make it up to you. We'll have you back after Fun Drive.